I am now reading from the first chapter of the Gospel of Mark, chapter 1, verses 9 through 12. In those days, Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. And just as he was coming out of the water, he saw the heavens torn apart and the Spirit descending like a dove on him. And a voice came from heaven, "You are my Son, the Beloved, and with you I am well pleased." And the Spirit immediately drove him out into the wilderness. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
You have known our choir director, Bill Coy, for a long time. Most often you hear him talking about music or see him directing music. And so you may not have had a chance to know him as I have, as a person of deep faith. He has inspired me many times in these 6 months that I have known him. And now that this is his last season among us before he and Lynn move in the spring, I wanted you to hear from him. And so Bill this morning shares his story as he has been changed.
Good morning, church. Even before Kathy asked me to do this, I had offhandedly said if I were ever to do this, I would call it I've evolved. And as I thought and went through this, I've evolved, but I've changed. And I've changed, and I've changed. And what I decided to do was list a couple of aha moments. Y'all know what an aha moment is? So it's one of those times, So I'm going to do this as an aha moment. I grew up rather normally. We went to church every Sunday because in the 50s and the 60s, that's what you did. And didn't mean a whole lot to me. It meant I got shoved into kindergarten or first grade, second grade, whatever, and the folks went to church. When we got to junior high school, it changed a little bit. We got dropped off. And, I guess it was time for Mom and Dad to get a little more time without my brother and I tearing things up in the house. But, the church I went to, I truly grew up in, had a very strong group of parents that led our junior high and then our high school groups. I didn't know that for a while. At 13, I went into confirmation class, and that was a bore. And I know that it'll be different here. I know that at one time I had managed to memorize the Beatitudes and the books of the New Testament. I got to go to PSR, to the library museum there, and I got to go to Glide and see worship there, which was probably the most meaningful part of confirmation. But Confirmation Sunday is aha number one for me. There were about 17 of us, about the same size as our class here. And they brought us up to the front of the church, and we were there. It seemed like for most of the service, it was probably 5 minutes. But Lewis Knight and Jim Manley, who were the pastors at the time, put us through the answer question, "Do you believe?" da-da-da-da-da-da. We answered it by rote. And then we kneeled for a blessing. And it hit me somehow. I was trembling. I was shaking. And I don't know why. Why is a 13-year-old trembling? And it wasn't trembling out of fear. It wasn't trembling out of I'm cold. It wasn't trembling. It was excitement. And thinking back through my life, something must have happened that day. God came up and slapped me side the head and said, listen. Aha 2 came 8 years later, same church. A fellow by the name of Bill Johnson, who had been my youth leader in high school, came to the San Carlos United Church of Christ and said, I want you folks to support my ordination to the ministry. And oh, by the way, I'm gay. That is a turning point. We spent a year amongst the Golden Gate Association of the UCC, Northern California's local group, in discernment. What did this mean? Should we support this man? And there were a lot of gymnastics that went on that time, a lot of political things. And it was a tough time. Being a delegate to that organization, I was involved in the education meetings, and I knew Bill. I knew Bill as a person, and I knew what Bill could bring to the ministry, and I knew what Bill could bring. I knew Bill's Christian faith. And sitting with people who were just so opposed to letting this man be a minister just because of one aspect of his being, just I could not understand. Well, through all of that, after the rhetoric had ended and Bill read his statement, was cross-examined, and escorted out of the room for a vote, it passed. And Bill became the first openly gay person from a major denomination to be accepted for ordination. Something I don't have down here, but I'll bring up to you, is that sometimes when you're a pioneer, you get the pioneer, but you don't get to do much else. To this day, Bill has never had a parish. He's been very active in the major church and has head up education programs in the UCC for AIDS awareness and for LGBT concerns, but he has never been called to a church. But he opened the door for a lot of other folks. Aha 3. At 21, I was called to be a music director at the church I'd grown up in. Now, call is kind of a hard word to digest. I know I've had discussions with Lynn on it. When you're doing something like I do in a church, it's different than being hired. I'm sure there's music directors that are hired, but I don't consider it being hired. When I become a music director in a congregation, I'm all in. And I hope that you have noticed that. I'm completely in. It's a calling. I didn't know it when I was called that would be the beginning of now almost 41 years of music ministry. I was a bassoon major. I was in my junior year of college. And as a line that I use on my kids a lot, you don't know what you don't know. And so I went in and became a choir director. And as this choir has learned, I make it up as I go. And I learn every time we get together, maybe a little different way of teaching this, a little different way of teaching that, but it's my style, and I'm still doing it. Aha number 4. I have had two other significant faith traditions enrich my life. When I first got to know Lynn, she had a passion for her Catholic faith. And at that time, we started discussing things of faith. And I had always had an interest, a curiosity about Catholicism. And I followed that up with taking the class and joining the church, participating in the church. I sometimes filled in as cantor. And I learned a great respect for the liturgy, a great respect for Catholics' spiritual journeys, for the culture. And, okay, some of you are not going to like to hear this, but when I hear people say, oh, that's too Catholic, or, oh, the Catholics do that, it burns me. It burns me here, because the Catholics are no different than us. We just do it a little different. But when you get down to what happens on a Sunday at Mass, and what you get down to what happens here, it's pretty darn close. I also, this is 4.1. A longtime friend asked me if I would consider being the High Holy Day choir director for her temple over in Fremont. And here's another faith that I've always had great interest in, Judaism. And I went, I met with the rabbi, and I met with the woman that headed up the music committee, such as it is, and we had a long talk. And they invited me to come and lead their choir. You want to get down to it? There's not a lot that happens different there on Saturday than happens here on Sunday. You know, there's a prayer that they say that almost sounds like the Lord's Prayer. I dare say we copped it. And there's singing, and there's joyfulness, and there's a welcome that is just awesome. I got invited back. Again, I did another year, and I've been invited back several times since and just have not done it because I didn't feel I was the right mix. They needed to get somebody who could lead them, play piano, who had a better understanding for them, and I just was not talented enough for them. I think what this all boils down to for me is that we're all the same. We're all different, and that's what makes it great, but we're all the same. And when you look at people as you walk down the street and you take a look at them and go, oh, he must, blah, 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 or those damn, blah, 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 stop. And think about them. Because they're not that much different than you. They love, they hurt. I wish I had written out the lines, Shylock's lines from Merchant of Venice, do I not bleed? Because that's what it is. That's what it is. They are loved by God. Makes no difference who they are. And God and Jesus' stories are love. And if I can do anything, I commend you to love these people. Consider them. Think about them. I got a couple other things I want to read to you, and they're really short. There's a line from Colossians 3:16. Christ's message in its richness must live in your hearts. Teach and instruct one another with all wisdom. That group of people that were up here this morning being commissioned, they are your responsibility. Yes, they have mentors, they have teachers, but you are responsible for them as well. To hold them up in your hearts, to answer their questions, should they be brave enough to ask you, and to maybe engage them in discussion so they will feel comfortable in engaging with you. And then the last thing kind of puts my musical ministry into focus for me. This is a quote I found in the Mercury. Remember when the Mercury had a religion page? And it was a darn good religion page. Well, there's a cantorial performer. He goes around and does service music in a concert setting. And I carried this quote around in a little piece of paper in my wallet for a long time until Lynn had it framed. If you want to go up to my office in the Amy, it's over the piano in a beautiful shadow box, and it'll be there for a couple more weeks. But the quote is, music, like the Hasidim say, is the highest form of touching the heart. And beneath all the notes, there has to be some higher goal. For me, it's to tell people that God is with us. Thank you.
There's a seminary professor named Heather Murray Elkins who tells a story about a time she led a retreat for her students. The texts for the retreat were the stories of some important characters in the Bible. Abraham, Jacob, Moses, David, all those people whose stories we read to tell us something about who God is. And at the end of the retreat, she asked each of the participants to say which of those characters, those faithful people, they most identified with. Who they thought of as having the kind of faith or personality or story that was most like theirs. She was asking her students essentially to rename themselves, to identify with the name of a biblical character so that as they left the retreat, they might carry that name with them. It would remind them of that character's experience and of his or her own calling to faith. So for the closing exercise of the retreat, they all sat in a circle, and one at a time, each student came to a chair in the middle and spoke out loud the name that they had chosen and said a few sentences about why, what they appreciated about that character's story, and why they identified with him. Finally, every person had taken their turn except for one young man. So Dr. Elkins turned to him and said, "Do you want to participate? Do you have a name you want to take for yourself?" she asked him. And he got up slowly and he walked to the center of the circle and he finally sat down. "I thought about it a lot," he said. "But I couldn't think of a name that was stronger than the name that I have had my whole life." "What is that name?" she asked him gently. And he answered slowly and painfully. "Not good enough," he said. "All my life, my name has been not good enough. There is no other name that fits me as well." "That is not your name," they wanted to say, but they didn't, because they had learned somewhere that sometimes it is most important just to listen. And so every person in that room sat silently for a few moments. And then one by one, without saying a word, all of them in that circle went to the young man in the center. And they put their hands on his shoulders. And then someone said out loud the words that Jesus heard at his baptism. "You are my beloved child. With you I am well pleased." And if we put that into words that might go easier into our ears, we might hear God say, "You are the child of my heart. You make me very happy." Those were the words that this young man needed to hear. Those are the words we all need to hear. Those were the words that changed Jesus' life. The words he no doubt kept coming back to later, every time he was tempted to forget who he was. Remember that Jesus was baptized before he began doing any of the work that we know him for. The way Mark tells the story, Jesus' baptism happens in chapter 1, suggesting that maybe his life was unremarkable until he heard those words. No wise men, no angels singing about his birth, just this moment when he stepped into a river and let his cousin John pour water over his head. And then a sudden realization, an epiphany, about who he was and what he was called to do. Luke's gospel begins with all those stories that we do tell at Christmas: shepherds, stars, a manger. This story of Jesus' baptism appears a little bit later, but still there is this moment, this giving of a new name, beloved child of God, that happens before Jesus steps forward to preach his first sermon. In fact, all four gospels, every version of the story of Jesus' life that the early church thought was important to pass down, every one of them includes the story of Jesus' baptism, as though it is critical to understanding who he is. And then they tell us Jesus went off into the desert by himself. For 40 days he was alone. We might think of this as a vision quest, the kind of experience that Joseph Campbell talks about as part of every hero's journey, or a rite of passage that many cultures require of their young people as they become adults. Maybe the reference to 40 days is meant to remind us of the 40 years that Jesus' ancestors, the Israelites, walked in the wilderness while they were led by Moses, making a road to the promised land. Whatever the backstory is, whether we understand Jesus' path as universal or specific to his tradition, this too, this time of being alone, face to face with his own demons, seemed to be critical to the writers who wanted us to know who Jesus was. While he was out there, Mark says, he was tempted by Satan. This too is part of every hero's and maybe every person's journey. But here's what I know about being tempted. It never feels like Satan who's tempting me. If someone was wearing a name tag that said, "Hello, I'm the devil," it wouldn't be all that tempting to do what they said. It would be easy to walk away. What tempts me is much more subtle than that. Temptation comes from a voice that I'm more likely to trust, maybe my own. My tempter's voice sounds a lot like self-doubt, or sometimes anger or fear. Sometimes my pride saying, you can do better, or that shouldn't have happened to you. Sometimes it sounds like me wondering, why shouldn't you have everything you want? Who said it was wrong anyway? I'm only likely to call these thoughts temptations after I've resisted them. Until then, they have snuck into my head wearing clothes that make them look like a lot of good reason. Out there by himself, hungry and alone, it didn't take long before misgivings started to settle in for Jesus. And every one of them was designed to make him doubt what he'd heard at his baptism. Every question began with the words, if you really are the Son of God, prove it, the voice challenged. If you're so sure you're related to God, act like a God. Exercise your power, make something happen. Turn rocks into bread, you shouldn't be hungry. Throw yourself off the cliff and see what happens. You're invincible, right? You know how this part of the story ends. Jesus refused to let that voice of temptation take him over. He held on to the name he'd received, beloved child. He didn't have to prove anything. He remembered that he had heard a call to pour himself out for others, not to bolster his own ego. I'm pretty sure I wouldn't have been so strong or so grounded. No doubt Jesus had to sift through many voices in his head, just like we would. But he kept coming back to the one voice that gave him the identity that was most true, the identity that called the best out of him. Beloved child, child of my own heart. Now, this name wasn't a badge that he earned by deserving it. He got the name first. That's what happens for us at baptism, too. Whether we are baptized as infants or youth or young adults, baptism is a naming ritual, a moment when we take on a new identity. So at baptism, we receive two names, actually. The individual name that we've been given by our parents that distinguishes us from every other person. And another name, Christian, Christ one, follower of Jesus the Christ. Often we get that name, Christian, before we even begin to know what it means to be a Christian, and before we know where following Jesus might take us or what it will ask of us. The way Luke tells the story, Jesus went back to his hometown shortly after he finished his wilderness trip. His synagogue family welcomed their promising young adult home from college, and they invited him to speak. He read a section from the Bible that most of the people were already familiar with, verses from Isaiah that began with the words, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. God has named me to bring good news to the poor, release to people who are bound up, freedom to the people who have gotten caught in an unfair system." The people in the synagogue weren't surprised to hear that reading. They'd heard those words a million times as part of the good and comforting, far-off picture of God that they had gotten used to. But then Jesus preached his sermon. He didn't spend time digging into the background of the scriptures, and he didn't ask, "What do you think this means?" or "Isn't this interesting?" His sermon was one sentence, one clear, unambiguous sentence. Today is the day. Now is the time. This is what I came to do. Think about how much courage it took to be that clear. It took a lot of courage to be Jesus. Think about how dangerous it was and how much courage it took for Jesus to challenge a group of self-righteous people who were standing in front of him with rocks in their hands when they brought to him a woman that they had caught in adultery. How filled with trust he had to be when he told thousands of people to sit down and get ready to eat when all he had in front of him was 5 little loaves of bread and 2 fish. It took a lot of courage to be Jesus. Not too long after he began his ministry, Jesus invited a few people to follow him, to watch him close up so they could learn to do what he did. Disciples, we call them. And the last thing he said to them was, "Now you go be Jesus." That took a lot of courage, too. Taking on the name Christian, follower of Jesus, set those disciples apart in some way, even from lots of other good people, people they knew and loved, people who they admired. Following Jesus meant then, just like it does now, entering a long and courage-demanding process of transformation. It involves learning a new way of life, living by a different set of values from most of the world. Disciples have to be willing to leave behind the comfort of fading into the background when courage and conviction are what is needed. You have to trust you are standing on solid ground before you can even imagine doing this. You have to have heard and keep hearing a voice reliable enough to drown out all those other voices, the ones that say, "What makes you so sure?" Or, "Who do you think you are?" "You are the child of my heart. You make me very happy. Now you go be Jesus." This is the voice that speaks your name. This is the name you have been given. Can you hear it? Amen.